We're talking with Rich Hoffman and Robert Powell of the SCU, the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, about some amazing cases that they've dug into. Still to come, we're going to talk about Stephenville. And in this hour, I want to bring up the question about metamaterials. We're hoping that there's going to be some news about analysis of these strange materials taken from alleged crash sites. What these gentlemen know about it. I know Robert has written a paper about a pretty famous UFO metamaterial case from down in Brazil. We're going to get into that and more in the next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. 13 years ago this month, the skies of North Texas were filled with UFOs. They were detected on several radar. Witnesses saw them. The proximity to a presidential residence made it a high-profile case. And Robert Powell, you were right there on the ground doing the investigations. Can you fill us in, remind us of what was seen, what the events, how they unfolded, and how hard it was to dig up evidence on this?
Sure. This happened in January of 2008, and this was in Stephenville, Texas, which is about 70 miles southwest of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And before telling the story of what happened, I would like to give an honor to the reporter who really broke this story, and it made national news that year. Her name is Angela Joyner.
Yeah.
And Angela passed away from COVID just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, sad. Yep.
But I want to honor her because this case would never have happened if it hadn't been for Angela. And she was a good friend of mine, someone who I got to know over the years. And I'm sad to see her pass. It even made the Larry King show, and he passed from COVID also. But basically what happened, we got dozens of reports of this object. It was, most of the time, it was a light in the sky moving at extreme speeds. And so we had dozens of these reports. So I drove up to Stephenville, interviewed these people in person, and after interviewing all of them, I wanted to get the radar data, something I could verify as to what they were seeing. So before I got the radar data, it took months to get that. I got it from five different radar sites from the FAA. One of the best witnesses was a constable who told me about a case, about his sighting, which he gave me all the specific data, like the F-16s that flew by, that the object was 2 miles southwest of his home, and then he goes into his home, comes back out, and now you have lights all up above him, and then suddenly they move to the northeast at an extreme speed. Okay, so now that I know, right, but I don't have the radar data. Well, I get the radar data months later, and I begin to look at that radar data. So I look at where this constable's home is on the radar data, and I see an object 2 miles south of his home, just like he had told me. And then the amazing thing, and this got me really excited, on the radar data, you see the object move to the northeast, just as he described, and I calculated the speed, and the speed was 1,900 miles per hour. And that's basically from zero to 1,900 miles an hour within 10 seconds or less. And that was absolutely amazing. And that's what really, I thought, really made this case was detecting the object there. We also detected the object moving towards the Crawford Ranch, which at the time was President Bush's White House away from D.C. I've never had a case where you had such good radar data to track the object.
And it was tough for you to get this info. As I recall, you were filing all kinds of FOIA requests and got redacted versions of it and some denials.
Yes, but we finally got it. The event happened in January. We got the data finally in March or April. And myself and another gentleman, Greg Schultz, an engineer who had worked at Los Alamos, we worked on that data from April to June, July, nonstop, and we're finally able to put out a report. And in that report, which is on the SCU website, we tracked the F-16s. There were F-16s in the air that night. We tracked them everywhere they went and where they were located, so we knew that was not what the witnesses saw, because we knew the direction the witnesses were looking, and the F-16s were not in that location. And there was also what we believe was an AWACS plane, because there was an aircraft at 80,000 feet that was flying the number 8 shape, a race car track shape, up at 40,000 plus feet, which is indicative of something like an AWACS plane. And here was the interesting thing, George. So all this activity is occurring between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock at night. Well, and this is all in Texas. Well, at around 6:30, there had been two jets, which we tracked, that went up into Oklahoma that were at a military operating area up there doing bombing runs. Well, when those guys are done at about 8 o'clock, they don't fly back to the Fort Worth Air Base, which used to be called Carswell. Instead, these guys fly due south over Stephenville, work their way back east, and then go back up to Carswell. So it's just like someone told them, hey, when you guys are done, go check out what's going on in the Stephenville area, because they flew out of their normal flight zone to go. And what's the odds that they just happened to fly over Stephenville later that night?
So you have to wonder. I mean, obviously, there's no way you can know this, but these mystery aircraft, were they trying to get the president's attention, trying to buzz that or to get the military's attention by flying in proximity that seems kind of threatening, at least to the president? What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, that one was tough for me to wrap my head around as to why this object is flying towards there. Now, so your listeners know, this object has no transponder, so it is not a aircraft that is being controlled by the FAA. There's no transponder on it. It is a unknown flying directly towards Crawford Ranch. Well, I mean, the amazing thing was there were none of these F-16s were trying to intercept it. And so I'm just thinking, I mean, is this like some CIA guy just thought this would be funny to fly a drone or something towards Crawford Ranch and see what happens? I mean, but the problem of it being a drone was this object was capable of traveling as slow as 37 miles an hour on the radar and as fast as 500 miles an hour. And this took place for at least 30 minutes. So on its track, you can't do that with a helicopter, because a helicopter can't reach 500 miles per hour speed. And you can't do that with like a Harrier jet, because it was at 37 miles an hour for so long, your Harrier jet's basically hovering at that type of speed, and it would use up way too much jet fuel over 30 minutes. So it's not a Harrier jet, and the acceleration to get to the 500-plus miles per hour, that took place, that went from 37 to 500 miles per hour in less than 10 seconds, which is a very high acceleration rate. So as to what it is, you know, we never knew, but it was part of that whole night, everything that went on. We did have one report from a policeman that night who saw the object with two other policemen, but I only got to talk to one of the three policemen, and he described the object that he saw. He said it was a city block long, and he could not tell if it was a disc, a rectangle, or a triangle, because he said the object was so large, all he saw was what he was looking at edge on. And then, here's the amazing thing this policeman told me. He said he turned his radar on it, and it was moving at 27 miles an hour, this huge object. But here's the kicker. All of a sudden, this object that's, you know, kind of level turns vertical, like if you had a pencil, and all of a sudden you turn it straight up, which, that's totally non-aerodynamic, and then it takes off and leaves. So if this policeman was going to make up a story, why would you make up a story of an object that, you know, horizontal like it normally should be, like a or a plane or a disc, and then turns vertical 90 degrees and then starts flying? I mean,
Rich Hoffman, anything to add to that, to the significance of that case? I mean, you put this report on the SCU website. It's very comprehensive, easy to read, as sort of a public service. Do you get much traffic on that site? And what would you say is the significance of that Stephenville report?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, yeah, we do get traffic on our site. I mean, I'm not sure that I'm tracking it specifically to that document, but that document, I mean, overall, the work that Robert did on that case was phenomenal. And it was, you know, once again, an excellent case that stands the test of time that no one's been able to account for. Yeah, I mean, it's just a great case. I can't really add anything beyond what Robert said about it, because he's really the one that did all the work and the investigation on it, for sure.
Let's talk about metamaterials a little bit. Rich, are you optimistic that we're going to learn something about these metamaterial samples allegedly retrieved from crash sites? Strange materials, Jacques Vallée, we've heard that he's writing a book about it and had been working on analyzing materials with Gary Nolan. There's, of course, the TTSA guys that said that they had an agreement with the U.S. Army. Any thoughts on whether there's going to be progress or whether we're going to hear an announcement in 2021?
Yeah, that's an interesting topic. Of course, you know, I've followed a long time the memory metal that was in, allegedly came out of Roswell, which, by the way, was connected to Battelle Memorial Institute, and, you know, that they had that relationship with Blue Book. And so then you had that kind of thing. So metal alloys and this memory metal, if you would, and this metamaterials are a fascinating subject to me. I'm encouraged by the fact that they're doing the work. I know Gary Nolan, of course, if you saw the movie that James Fox did, you know, you got to see Gary Nolan talking about the material that Jacques Vallée had given him, I guess. And, you know, some of this stuff is quite interesting in the sense that it just, you know, the isotopic ratios don't match, and there's some other kind of unusual characteristics about them. And I think that, you know, if indeed Lou and them were working with that CRADA with, you know, it used to be called, when it was underneath Army Material Command, it was called, it was part of PACOM organization, and it was their R&D, TARDEC. And it's changed its name since, because we moved it underneath the Army Futures Command, and so they've got a different name to it. But I don't know what the extent of the passing of the information over to those scientists or not, and how that's been working out. I am hopeful that they can have peer reviews done on it and learn something from it. And I'm optimistic that maybe something will come from it. But, you know, like in the past, we've had so many other kind of cases where you've had materials. I mean, if you take a look at Ted Phillips. That
oh, yeah.
All of the collection of, you know, over 4,000 kinds of things, the incidents where we had ground materials from cases, you know, and then the Delpos case and all these other cases where we've tried to find some sort of an indication of, you know, something of a significance that would tie it to aliens. It just never worked out. And my concerns around these metals are the chain of custody and some of the other things in terms of, like, knowing where specifically they came from How were they handled during the time that they have been passed around? And those are all elements of a good, strong case. That's in my opinion, anyway. And so Robert will probably tell you more about that as well. So
I'm going to ask him about Ubatuba in a second here. Before we leave you, I want to ask about crashes, just in general.
Yeah.
So if you listen to the whole field, people finding crash materials, metamaterials from alleged crash sites, and I know whenever this comes up, the public asks me, well, why so many crashes if they are coming from far, far away places, you know, the other edge of the universe, and they get here and they crash? Is it on purpose? Are they throwing us a bone to, here, give us something to keep us busy, throw a cell phone in the chimpanzee cage to knock yourself out kind of a thing? What's your take on it, Rich, and then Robert, yours?
Okay, well, you know, for me, it's a situation where I had a chance to work with Len Springfield, you know, who had done all that work on, you know, crash retrievals and was getting a lot of testimony from a lot of different people about alleged crash sites. And I think he came up with something on a scale of about 200 crashes he documented. But, you know, a lot of them just didn't really have, you know, enough evidence to really validate them and support that they actually did happen. And it's like, you know, obviously, as you very well know, even with the Roswell incident, allegedly you had teams of people cleaning up the area and all the evidence was gone. So if there has been some of these crashes and stuff like that, which there was a lot of speculation might have been due to the fact that we were installing a radar system and had very high powered radar that was just coming out at that time, which they scaled back on. That might have had some sort of an impact on their whatever these objects are and how they fly, but again, that's just speculation and we have nothing to go on. But we do have reports of materials that are dropping from objects. We have materials of a variety of other kinds of cases where you had allegedly a crash, if you would. And that's just the nature of the whole phenomenon and the reports have been of these kinds of things. But we don't know enough about why they crash or anything more than that, other than the fact that they do. And there are materials found, and a lot of these things are showing some, so are very unusual properties or are being alleged. You know, and let's just wait and see, I guess, is where I'm at. And it'd be great if we actually got something that could, help us to push the fact that these things are not from here forward.
Robert, we go to a break in about 45 seconds. Just give me your take on the same kind of question. I suppose if these are advanced craft from an intelligent civilization beyond us, doesn't mean they're omnipotent. They could crash, right?
They could. I have not seen evidence yet to convince me there has been any ship that has ever crashed on our planet. And if there, my take is also that if that had happened, it would be the same way our military operates. They would be down there picking up the pieces and removing everything before we ever got to it. So I just can't believe you would have an advanced race who crashes their ship and then leaves it there.
Right. Also, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a foreign element, metal unknown on Earth. If they've been here a long time, they could make whatever their craft are from stuff that they find here and mine. We'll come back to this subject of metamaterials, in particular Ubatuba, which is some interesting samples that Robert analyzed. I know it's stormy all over the country right now, and probably people are snowed in and are looking at the sky and shaking their fists. Here in the Mojave Desert, we went something like 260 days with no measurable rain. We finally had rain this month, rain, snow, hail. It's great to see it. I don't know if it's what the vibe you get from a rainstorm, but I always feel good when it happens. We're talking with Rich Hoffman, Robert Powell, about the excellent work by the SCU, the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. Their website is terrific. If you ever need a resource to read in depth about some of their investigations or these key cases, I want to talk a little bit in the next segment about UFO politics, because, you know, to dive into this endeavor to do these kinds of investigations, you have to be made of stern stuff because you're going to have to deal with all kinds of nonsense. It just kind of comes with the territory. Ufology eats its own. It loves to attack people who come in with new information. Everyone is assumed to be some kind of a secret agent spreading disinformation until proven otherwise. So the kinds of people like Lou Elizondo, Chris Mellon, who come forward trying to move the ball down the field, they get whacked on a regular basis. Want to talk about that a little bit. Then back into the Ubatuba metamaterials case, that investigation, and a lot more still to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Powell, one of the papers you wrote for the SCU website is about Ubatuba. I don't know if you wrote it for that, but that's where it is right now. This is a pretty famous case. It wasn't a UFO crash, as I recall. It was more about some kind of slag-like material that fell out of this object in the sky. Can you bring us up to date on that, recap the story, what people, witnesses said they saw, and what kind of conclusions you may have come to in your paper?
Yeah, the Ubatuba case came out of Brazil. It happened in 1957, and it's basically a gentleman, an anonymous source, who said he was out fishing near the ocean when an object came streaming into the atmosphere, extremely bright, and it exploded. So, and he said it showered pieces of metal all over the area, so he picked these pieces of metal up. And he deposited them and just left them in an envelope at a newspaper and gave his story of what happened. And then he left. No one ever got to talk to the guy or anything. So there's definitely no trail of, you know, where did this come from? However, if you look at isotope ratios, you can tell if a material is made on Earth or not. And so that's kind of where this story begins. And the first tests that were done on this material, they said this is absolutely 100% pure magnesium. Well, no one in 1957 could have made 100% pure magnesium. Now, since then, we've been able to determine it wasn't quite 100%. It's like 99.88%. I spent a year working with two different labs doing an analysis on this material. Now, the really strange thing is that that 0.12% is made up of strontium and barium and a little bit of copper and zinc. Strontium is not a byproduct that is ever put into magnesium. That has to be intentionally placed into it. And it, in 1957, no one was putting strontium into magnesium. There was one case of it happening, and that was Dow Chemical had done an experiment where they tried to do that. So what I did is I took these samples, and I used two different labs to try to duplicate the results. And these samples I got from Dr. Michael Swords, who got them from Dr. Peter Sturrock. I think they're probably, if Jacques Vallée has done any work on Ubatuba, his samples would be from that same source, from Dr. Peter Sturrock.
I'm 99% pure. Nobody's making that in 1957 either.
No, I could not find anyone who made 99.88% pure magnesium. I mean, that within itself is a mystery. And then you add that the strontium was in it also, at roughly 200 to 300 parts per million. And you basically have a piece of material that you can't explain. So I was looking for, okay, what are the isotope ratios? So I used a lab in Austin and a lab in Cleveland. And the Austin lab indicated that the magnesium isotope ratios were outside of normal terrestrial ranges, while the Cleveland lab indicated that they were normal. And I also had both labs test the impurities, the strontium, the zinc, the copper, and the barium. And unfortunately there, the Cleveland lab said, okay, the zinc is outside normal, you know, boundaries, while in the Austin lab it was okay, but the Austin lab had the barium, outside normal boundaries. So it was clear it is very difficult for anyone to calculate the isotope ratios on these elements that are at parts per million. It takes some very skilled work to do that. So in the end, what I concluded was, could the magnesium have been an isotope ratio outside of the norm? Maybe, because that's what the Austin lab indicated. But to be able to say that convincingly, you have to have repeatable results from multiple labs. Since the Cleveland lab indicated it was normal, at this point in time, I have to conclude that, you know, the magnesium is most likely terrestrial magnesium. The strontium and barium, we don't really know for certain. But the strangeness of 99.88% magnesium with strontium in it is still, you know, that is still an unknown. It's not explainable.
Rich, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, to get to the bottom line is, so could that have been some type of spacecraft that exploded, right? And that metal was not made on Earth and came from there. That's possible, but can you prove that that's the case? No, not at this time. It can't be proven.
Yeah, you can't prove it, absolutely, but it's a pretty strong indication that somebody pretty smart made that stuff back in 1957. Rich,
to be engineered in a state-of-the-art lab for 1957 for that to have, and how it got into a Brazilian newspaper office, who knows?
Rich, the fact that there's no unobtainium, no unknown element never discovered on Earth before, maybe that's never going to happen. The same materials, elements are throughout the universe, or at least as far as we know. But, if you were an alien civilization that lived here for hundreds or thousands of years, you could use Earth materials refined in ways that humans are still not able to do. I guess you're never going to have absolute proof if it's Earth materials. But it's pretty persuasive when you think of, some of these other samples that we are told are being analyzed right now, metamaterials, engineered in a way that we can't do, hasn't been accomplished here before, maybe even made in zero gravity, which is part of the research that Robert Bigelow has done out here, which is one of the reasons he wanted to have a space program of his own, was to be able to make medicines and things of that sort that were made in zero gravity that can't be made on Earth. Can you address that, the general subject?
Yeah, I mean, metamaterials have been I remember reading that they've been around for quite some time in terms of our research on them. But, I mean, ultimately, you're taking, down at the nano level, if you will, and you're bringing these kinds of materials together that we have electromagnetic properties. They've also got properties to be able to, I know that there were some tests in them to be able to do cloaking. And so they have, when you're getting down to that level, you're actually, you're constructing this material and it has these very unusual properties to it. We look to be able to figure out how to use these materials. And material science has, progressed exponentially. In fact, we're using artificial intelligence to be able to help us now to be able to construct these materials. And so, I mean, it's phenomenal, that kind of like technology, if you would. So, I mean, the fact that we're seeing these things, these materials, and we're finding them, I think it's pretty phenomenal. But let me share with you that you run into the same kind of situation Robert just talked about, in the sense that, well, it's like 99% magnesium, and oh, by the way, we can't do it in that time period or something like that. And we can find things with unusual isotopic ratios and stuff like that, but we don't really have the means to be able to come up and say there's something from off Earth, like you just got to saying, because most of the materials that we're composed of and our bodies and everything else are from star material that's exploded. And so I think you're going to find it throughout the universe. And so it's a very difficult case to prove. And that's why I'm like anxiously waiting for the work that they're doing, to see how it's going to be looked at with other labs and the kind of like, Robert experienced different kinds of results from the two different labs. And you'll probably have the same thing going on here. But we just hope that at some point you can get something where you'd be able to say, well, wait a minute, we've got unusual properties the mixture of these materials are doing something that rather unique that you can't find anywhere on this planet, and it would be off planet the way you'd construct it, whether it be in the vacuum of space or something of that nature. That's going to help you make a case, but wow, I'd love to have that happen.
I in your bio, it says you've been at this for 56 years. So I'm figuring you were 4 years old when you started chasing UFO mystery, something like that. But it seems like, and it's frustrating, it's fun, it's exciting, it's worthwhile, but it is frustrating that ultimate proof is always tantalizingly just outside our reach. It not only is it the incompetence of investigations and the nasty nature of the UFO business and what it's like in this field, but the ultimate imposition of secrecy comes from them, whoever they are, wherever they're from. They could make themselves known. They have not. They give us these glimpses now and then, and they don't seem to mind that we are interested, but it's always just kept tantalizingly out of our reach. You must be frustrated with that at times.
Oh, I'm extremely frustrated, and to me, and Robert and I, we worked on, you mentioned that we were on the Science Review Board, and we would look at cases that were, allegedly investigated, and we could see that, that there was a lack of trained investigators or people coming in with bias on them, and so, going back to, if you were really going to take this subject seriously and do the proper work as a country or as a world body, then you wouldn't be using volunteer kinds of investigators. You'd be using highly qualified people to go out and collect the evidence, if you would. And we would be using all the tools we had across the planet to be able to do it. And we have everything from satellites we're putting up to now track, the MH370 or something like that, aircraft, whether they're over the ocean or whatever. If you really put that to work, if you also had all that math, and they call it the measures and signals, and the intelligence that we can get, like the radar and sonar or in those other kinds of things. If you had all that collectively working for you as a country or as a government, then, and you've collected that into a single database where you could have people that can be dispatched and go out immediately and collect the proper kind of evidence using the proper tools, we would be so much further along, And then if you had that data shared with scientists, and scientists like, Kevin Canoes and everybody else that are in these parts of SCU now that are coming on board that work in academia, just think what we would have, George, by now. We would have an incredible way of being able to give answers to things like this, and we're just not doing it. And it's left to, people who don't have a dime that are trying to do this, for years like we've been doing it, and it's a shame. It's a downright shame.
Well, here's just add to what Rich just said there. Think about the Nimitz case in 2004 and the more recent cases in 2015 that involved Navy carrier strike groups. The Navy has the radar data that could say this object traveled at X speed and accelerated at Y acceleration. There's no doubt about that. Yet, why aren't they doing the work to say here's that object's speed and acceleration, and telling the Congress that instead of just saying, we don't know what they are? There's data they've got that they can use.
Well, maybe they have done that. There are these closed-door briefings that have been underway for the last couple of years. I suspect that they maybe have shared a lot more information than you or I can get, Robert, and that radar data would certainly be something somebody to look at. You know, we had I had Lou Elizondo on the show back in December, and he dropped so many bombs and Easter eggs. I think a lot of it went over people's heads, and of course
I caught him.
Well, one of them was about Skinwalker. So I've written about Skinwalker a lot and spoken about it in public, and that investigation was sort of part of the OSAP program, BASS, put together by Bigelow. You know, you were saying, Rich, about how far along we could be. Well, BASS had almost 50 people working for it by 2012, and then the rug was yanked out from under them. But, man, just think how far they could be along the way if they'd been allowed to continue. The Skinwalker was part of it because it was a living lab, in essence. And I had asked Lou, well, look, can you solve this mystery, the overarching mystery, just by studying military encounters, nuts and bolts craft, encountering military units around the world? And he said, no, you know, that ultimately you need the kind of broad umbrella approach that BASS had, looking at related phenomena, paranormal kind of stuff that really gets into some strange areas. You know, you need that. But the chances of a program like that ever being funded again, I'd say, are pretty slim. The best we could hope for is, you know, an expanded version of the UAP Task Force, an expanded version of ATIP. And I hope somebody is at least considering something like that. But I think we're going to be out of time before you're able to answer this question. But I want you to think about if you could design a great model for a UFO UAP investigation, whether or not it would include some of these fringe subjects that are even weird by UFO standards. And when we come back, I'll get your take on that, and we'll open up the phone lines. I'd also like to touch on USOs, USO cases, whether or not you think there's some good solid evidence, whether Robert and colleagues will be writing a report on something like that. We're talking with Rich Hoffman and Robert Powell of SCU. Still have a lot of subject matter to cover. And when we come back, we're going to open up the phone lines. So put on your thinking caps, come up with some great questions for our guests, sort of focusing on researchable topics, what could be investigated, where you'd like to see it go, and what you hope is going to happen in the year 2021 as we move forward.